Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Hello and thank you for joining DW's Africa Link program. Live from Bonn, Germany, I'm Crispin Mwakideo.
And my name is Jen Nyinge. We are also live on our Facebook page at DW Africa. Coming up, Eritrean President Isaias Afewerki reopens his country's embassy in Addis Ababa. But this analyst says Africa and the world shouldn't trust him.
The regime in Asmara has no any language of peace. And the regime in Asmara has no any system to live in peace in the whole of Africa.
And in South Sudan, a UN arms embargo comes into effect amid criticism from the government.
We will still advise the United States that the only way to help this country as an ally, as a country with diplomatic ties with us, is not to impose punishment on the people of South Sudan.
We bring you these stories plus the much-touted Trump-Putin summit in Helsinki. We shall be back after we hear this short global news roundup.
I'm Christina Kripal with the DW News. U.S. President Donald Trump met his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin today in the Finnish capital of Helsinki. After talking alone for 2 hours, the two leaders held a working lunch with members of their staff. The summit was intended to improve U.S.-Russian relations, which have deteriorated in recent years as the two countries took opposing sides in conflicts in Ukraine and Syria. Talking to the press afterwards, Putin called the meeting a success. Trump concurred and said that bilateral relations had been at their worst, but only until 4 hours ago.
Today's meeting is only the beginning of a longer process, but we have taken the first steps toward a brighter future and one with a strong dialogue and a lot of thought. Our expectations are grounded in realism, but our hopes are grounded in America's desire for friendship, cooperation, and peace.
German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas said on Monday that Europe could no longer completely rely on the White House. Maas was reacting to U.S. President Trump referring to Europe as a foe in trade. Maas also said that Europe might have to readjust the partnership and joined a long line of politicians calling for closer ties among European Union members. In a joint declaration at a summit in the Chinese capital, Beijing, the EU and China announced a bilateral investment agreement. China also committed itself to improving access to home markets for foreign investors and the protection of intellectual property. Both sides warned against consequences of a trade war with the US following the imposition by President Trump of punitive tariffs on imports from China and Europe. This news comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany. German Development Minister Gerd Müller has called for the nomination of an EU Commissioner for Africa to strengthen the Union's policies on that continent. Müller said in an interview with a German newspaper that Europe was missing a once-in-a-lifetime chance in Africa. He criticized the EU budget for Africa as too small, comparing it to massive investments in the continent by China and Russia. Eritrea reopened its embassy in Ethiopia on Monday in a further step towards the normalization of relations between the countries after 2 decades of conflict. Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and Eritrea's President Isaias Afwerki inaugurated the embassy in the capital Addis Ababa. Speaking to DW, Eritrean analyst Mehari Johannes urged caution concerning the prospects of peace in view of what he called the dictatorship in his country.
Has no constitution, has no even national budget, there is no parliament, and there is no free court. This is simply a mafia government, one-man government. And how a state under one crazy man rule works for a sustainable peace and lasting reconciliation.
Gunmen shot dead 14 civilians in an attack on the village of Menanka in northern Mali on Sunday, a local official said today. It is a further incident amid a spate of killings by rival ethnic groups and jihadist militants that threatens to derail a presidential election later this month. The identity of the attackers has not been revealed. French police arrested 300 people celebrating France's title in the Football World Championship. 45 police were injured when riots broke out among celebrants in several cities on Sunday after France beat Croatia 4-2 in Moscow in yesterday's final. For more news and information, please visit our website at dw.com. I'm Christina Kripal.
You're listening to Africa Link program. My name is Jen Nyinge.
And I'm Crispin Mwakideo. A warm welcome to you listening live on our DW Africa Facebook page. Feel free to share your thoughts and opinions on the stories we are airing. And don't forget to share the link as well.
Yes, indeed. Now, history was made today as Eritrean President Isaias Afewerki reopened his country's embassy in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. It took nearly two decades of enmity and border wars, which claimed tens of thousands of lives, to get to this point.
Now, the rapprochement could help Ethiopia, a landlocked country, access Eritrea's ports. At the same time, better ties could help Eritrea overcome decades of international isolation. But Mihari Yohannis, a political analyst in Addis Ababa, told me the world should be wary of Afwerki.
For me, I think the dictator in Asmara is trying to maximize his personal interest. And Ethiopia is dealing with a single dictator. You have no guarantee for the peace. You have no guarantee for the peace. You have no guarantee for the terms of agreement. Dictator, he can turn apart the papers anytime he wants. And after all, Eritrea is under curfew for the last 10 years. And how this dictator can be a peace partner for the Ethiopian government, if not for a kind of tactical relationship between the two governments against the so-called common enemy somewhere. So, since the two countries are trying to mend their relationships, like opening the embassies as somewhat a symbolic gesture to the world and to the people of the two countries.
Ethiopia's foreign ministry says that it has not yet reopened its embassy in Asmara. What is the reason behind that? Because Ethiopia is the one who has been reaching out to Eritrea in the first place.
I don't know. Maybe there is no agreement in between the governments or the government circle. You know, Isaias is a single-man government. He is a regime. He is the state by himself. He can decide whatever he wants. But in Ethiopia, the government has many constraints regarding passing decisions. So there might be a challenge or disagreement regarding the opening up of the Ethiopian embassy in Asmara.
And what guarantees are there from Eritrea or from Ethiopia that whatever peace deal was signed will actually hold?
It's a deep-rooted problem. There are so many complicated factors that aggravated the conflict, the war, as well as the deadlock for the last 18 years. So without assessing and restructuring and resolving these complicated factors between Tigray, or Ethiopia, if you like, and Eritrea, is simply a mere diplomatic game or a kind of diplomatic gambling. So if Eritrea needs to reconcile or need a true reconciliation or peace resolution or conflict resolution between the two countries, that there should be a mechanism to assess all the root causes behind the conflict, as well as just the Eritrean people should know what's going on regarding the country. A single man can't decide the fate of the nation. And after all, for me, the regime in Asmara has no any language of peace. And the regime in Asmara has no any system to live in peace in the whole of Africa. And, you know, Eritrea has been in crisis. Eritreans are migrating to the whole of the world. Eritrea has no constitution, has no even national budget. There is no parliament, and there is no free court. This is simply a mafia government, one-man government. And how a state under one crazy man rule works for a sustainable peace and lasting reconciliation.
Mihari Yohannis, a political analyst in Addis Ababa. And just to remind you that Eritrea actually has this mandatory military service for its young people, which has been often criticized by rights group. And on our Facebook page, John Chege from Kitui, Kenya, says Eritrea should abolish this. It's not a voluntary exercise, which means some people feel exploited. It also affects people emotionally and alters their living in terms of earning a living, since strong men are recruited.
Thank you so much, John Chege, for that comment. We have this also from Mark Jr. And he says, yes, it's the right time for Eritrea to stop the suffering of her citizens. But we believe in one step at a time.
And Zeal from Nigeria says, exactly, I think the media should pressure the government of Eritrea to do just that and save thousands of lives of Eritreans.
And a controversial one here from Mausai, he says, once a dictator, it becomes difficult to impress the rule of law. This dictator will show a humane international face, but will continue to suppress his people by not allowing the youth to decide for themselves.
Let's wait and see what happens over at the Horn of Africa.
Absolutely. Now, moving on now to Helsinki, where after more than 2 hours of meeting face-to-face with Russian President Vladimir Putin, U.S. President Donald Trump declared that it was a very good start. Trump met Putin despite calls by both Democrat and his own Republican lawmakers to cancel it. Here is President Donald Trump.
During today's meeting, I addressed directly with President Putin the issue of Russian interference in our elections. I felt this was a message best delivered in person. Spent a great deal of time talking about it, and President Putin may very well want to address it, and very strongly, because he feels very strongly about it, and he has an interesting idea. The President and I also discussed the scourge of radical Islamic terrorism. Both Russia and the United States have suffered horrific terrorist attacks, and we have agreed to maintain open communication between our security agencies to protect our citizens from this global menace.
U.S. President Donald Trump at the summit in Helsinki, where he met Russian President Vladimir Putin. Now back to Africa, and let's head straight to South Sudan. Following a UN arms embargo, Juba has protested against the U.S. and the international community for derailing the peace efforts by imposing a ban on weapons.
The U.S.-led arms ban is meant to help put an end to a civil war which has killed tens of thousands and displaced millions of people. But as Wake Simon Udu reports, it's one thing to impose a ban and to implement it. It's totally a different thing.
Reacting to the UN arms embargo, the government, through its foreign affairs spokesperson, Mayuen Makol, says the arms ban will jeopardize the peace efforts. He instead called for cooperation between the international community and his government so as to achieve lasting peace.
The most important thing always is the commitment to bring the peace. And the peace may take days, may take months, may take years, and you still have to follow it because this is what you want to realize for your people.
The passing of the resolution follows countless efforts made by the U.S. government in lobbying the U.N. Security Council to cut off arms flow to South Sudan, a move which the Trump administration believes would minimize nearly 5 years' conflict, which has seen ethnic killings, gang rapes, and other atrocities taking place. But Mayuen Makol is of another view.
We will still advise the United States that the only way to help this country as an ally, as a country with diplomatic ties with us, is not to impose punishment on the people of South Sudan, but is actually to try to help and mediate between the stakeholders that are responsible about this peace settlement.
The resolution also imposed sanctions on South Sudan former Chief of General Staff Paul Malong Awan and Malek Robin Riak, a Deputy Chief of Defense. The two individuals were added to the UN sanctions blacklist hit by global visa and assets freeze. Wani Michael, executive director of OK Foundation, a civil society organization, welcomed the Security Council resolution, saying it will help reduce the violence in South Sudan. However, he said the UN Security Council needs to ensure proper implementation of the resolution and ensure all loopholes for smuggling guns into South Sudan are sealed.
We have been seeing so many resolutions from the United Nations Security Council coming out, but these resolutions have never been implemented adequately. So what we hope to see is how resolution is going to be implemented by the United Nations Security Council or even by the United Nations to ensure that at least these warring parties or these armed parties that are fighting does not have access to these weapons that they used to kill themselves, that they used to kill our people.
The arms embargo on South Sudan, among other sanctions, will run until May 2019.
Wake Simon Mudu in Juba. And now let's go back to our main story, that is Eritrea opening up its embassy in Addis Ababa. Remember, Eritreans are the ones, the largest group that are fleeing their country. And we have a comment from Ronald who says, I don't think that is the reason why they flee their country.
And Ngozi from Nigeria says, yes, it's time to stop wasting the lives of their young ones. Else we will come over and marry all their young girls. An interesting one there.
Yeah, they're known to have very, very beautiful women in Eritrea. And also in Ethiopia. So it's a good thing that it's happening, but at the same time, people are a bit wary. Anyway, keep those comments coming. We'll read them whenever we can. In case you're joining us, you're listening to DW's Africa Link. I'm Crispin Mwakideu.
And my name is Jen Nyinge. We are also live on our Facebook page, DW Africa. So feel free to drop us a line on the stories we are covering.
And coming up in the next 15 minutes. It's celebration time in France after the French team won this year's FIFA World Cup in Russia by beating Croatia 4-2 and winning the cup in 20 years.
First, before we go to those celebrations in France, we head to Mali, where gunmen shot dead 14 civilians in an attack on a village in northeastern part of the country. This comes amid a spate of killings by rival ethnic groups and jihadist militants that threatens to derail a presidential election later this month.
Political campaigns are going on with the main rivals, President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, and his main challenger, Soumaila Cisse, in various parts of the country. But underneath all the noise lie the real issues that are troubling Mali's 8 million voters. Is there any reason to re-elect President Keita? Who else might take the job in Mali? Bram Posthumus has been finding out.
Two campaign rallies from the main contenders of Mali's presidential elections. President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita is campaigning on what he says are his government's achievements since he came into office 5 years ago. His main challenger, opposition leader Soumaila Cisse, says that the government has delivered very little and that he will do a better job. Is he right? Yes, says political analyst Balan Jakite.
The most fundamental needs of the people are not being met. Water, electricity, education, what's more? Mali is larger than its capital, and when you leave Bamako, you can really see for yourself how bad the situation is.
Peace and security, infrastructure, an end to corruption, and decent basic social services. These promises earned Mali's current president a record 77% of the vote in 2013. But his popularity has plummeted and he will struggle to get a similar result this time. Maha Fomba, who has picked up a job as a gardener for lack of anything else, sees the biggest failure in education.
The new government should work on the education of our children. A lot of them have now become drug addicts and teachers find it very hard to control them. I think this is an issue the new government should deal with first. There is also the problem of food. There isn't enough of it and it's very expensive, so people go hungry.
This last point is confirmed by every Mali observer. Food prices have risen very fast and people's incomes just cannot keep up. Part of this is due to the widespread insecurity in central Mali, a former reliable breadbasket. Today, people are on the run instead of working in their fields. This song, launched in the first minute of this year, says it all. The politicians and the administrators of the country have failed us. And Malians, especially young Malians, want that to change. Listen to Mariam Diko, a young accountant.
I think our leaders must understand that we are no longer children. And we understand a lot of things. We will not vote for you because you give us money. We have so many problems now. We're looking for someone who will keep his promises. Our leaders must communicate with the people so they will know what the real problems are and we can finally come out of the shadows.
Mariam Diko touches on the heart of the problem. Mali's political elites are cut off from the population that faces the daily grind but survive on 1 or 2 euros per day. And in response, Malians have turned their backs on politics. That stadium where President Keita held his rally, it was full because Keita had paid some hugely popular artists to come and play for free. Longtime Mali observer and university lecturer Ivan Gijawa has a sobering truth about whoever wins the next election.
The Malian elites are somehow confiscating power without building a strong connection with their people. The legitimacy that you hold as Malian head of state or as Malian authorities comes from the outside, not necessarily from the inside.
Dependent on foreign money for their survival and on foreign troops for their security, Mali's political elites have become highly reliant on Western aid, especially from France. And that's not going to change whether Mali's next president is Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, Soumaïla Cissé, Cheikh Modibo Jara, to name the top three contenders, or any of the other 21 vying for the top post.
Bram Postumus reporting in Bamako, Mali.
And Crispin, at this point, would like to acknowledge those listening to us on our Facebook page, DW Africa. And we have Mark Edens Wagangs and Evangelist Carl, who is in Cameroon.
Right. So keep those comments and let's debate on the stories that we are airing here at Africa Link.
Health check.
Glaucoma is one of the main causes of blindness in developing countries. According to the World Health Organization, 4.5 million people are estimated to be blind as a result of primary glaucoma. The situation is especially dire in Ghana. According to the Glaucoma Association of Ghana, about 700,000 out of the 29 million Ghanaians suffer from this eye disease.
Now, Crispin, that's the second highest rate in the world. There are fewer than 50 specialists in the country, and even fewer are willing and able to perform the surgery necessary to treat the condition. Maxwell Sook met up with one eye specialist in Ghana who is stepping up at the fight against the disease.
So since when did you realize that you couldn't see well?
I come on this year.
58-year-old glaucoma patient Issa Salamatu is at a Tamale Teaching Hospital's eye clinic to see an ophthalmologist.
I was diagnosed with glaucoma 4 to 5 months ago.
Salamatu is among 700,000 Ghanaians currently suffering from the condition, according to the Glaucoma Association of Ghana. She has been diagnosed with advanced glaucoma.
The advanced glaucoma means that you don't see sight and sight. When you are walking, you don't see. Yes, yes.
That is Dr. Gilbert Batiaka Bonsana, an ophthalmologist who Salamatu sought services from. He has been offering free screenings to detect glaucoma since 2015. Up to 70 people visit the eye clinic every day. Despite the high number of patients, many Ghanaians are not aware of the disease at all, says Mohamed Jamal, a resident of Tamale.
I've been hearing people talking about it and more time on news and other things.
Have you checked your eyes?
No.
Why not?
Because I've never experienced any difference in my sight.
Jamal may be at risk. With open-angle glaucoma, the most common form of glaucoma, there are virtually no symptoms. It usually doesn't hurt if your eye pressure is increased. Vision loss is slow and begins with a peripheral or side vision and often goes undetected for a long time. The only way to know for sure is to get tested at an eye clinic. Vision loss cannot be regained and glaucoma can cause blindness if it's left untreated, says Dr. Bonsana.
By the time you start to have signs and symptoms, it's already late, it's already advanced, and we cannot reverse the vision. Whatever vision that has been lost is lost forever. It cannot be reversed.
Ghana is number one in Africa in the prevalence of glaucoma and number two in the world after St. Lucia in the Caribbean. The WHO recommends surgery as the best way to treat glaucoma, but this is quite expensive, and some of the drugs are not covered by health insurance. Another problem is the stigma, Dr. Bonsana says.
It's a big problem because these patients rather need family support. They need support from friends. But friends and family tend to shun them because they think that they were cursed.
Adamu Amba developed complicated glaucoma in her left eye and is now doing well after a successful cataract surgery for papillary blocked glaucoma. Complicated surgeries for cataract and glaucoma are not covered by health insurance in Ghana, which makes it difficult for sufferers to cater for their expenses.
I'm not fine. Well, as for first day, I can't even sit down. Saturday, I can't see. But now I can see small, small.
There are fewer ophthalmologists in Ghana due to a perceived lack of interest for doctors to specialize in the field for various reasons, including non-profiting nature of the sector, compared to other doctors, because many sufferers are mainly the poor who cannot afford to pay much money.
Maxwell Soak reporting there from northern Ghana. And Jen, it's quite sad to hear such stories about such illnesses that can cause lots of damage on people.
Absolutely. And there are lots of reactions on social media pertaining this story. And Daniel from Nairobi, Kenya says, indeed, the Ghanaians need to be worried. This rate is very high. They need to do something positive as early as possible. Also, other developing nations need to take action.
And Eduful Otabil from Ghana says, the country is under a serious threat. The health ambulance system is dead. The better initiated maternal health care system has collapsed. People go to hospital without treatment because of inadequate sick beds. I think the President of the Republic of Ghana, President Nana Akufo-Addo, needs some answers from the Health Minister, Mr. Kwaku Agyemang Manu.
And Benedict from Nigeria says, oh yes, they should be worried, and so should many other Africans. We live in the part of a world where access to good medical service is rare, but we must continue to hope and pray that things will get better as we get better leadership in our countries.
And Caleb Chawra from Nairobi says glaucoma is a scare to many. Ghanaians should be more than worried. Particularly my mother suffered, but thanks to efforts the government of Kenya put in place, at least many are getting assistance of free eye clinics, checks and fair treatment due to subsidies.
So please keep those comments flowing on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Right now, we go to sports, and the France national team has arrived in the country after their historic win in the just concluded World Cup Championship. The team won 4-2 against Croatia, giving the country its second World Cup win in 20 years.
That's right. And the French football team will drive down the tree-lined avenue in an open-top bus at around Paris before heading to the presidential palace for a reception hosted by President Emmanuel Macron. Nearly 3,000 people have been invited to the reception, including 1,000 youths from football clubs around the country.
That is the situation right now in Paris, as people are welcoming the French team after beating Croatia 4-2.
That's right. 15 members of French 23-man squad are of African descent, prompting goalscorer Antoine Griezmann to say that that's the France we love. Different origins, but we are all united. And this is what some Democratic Republic of Congo fans had to say.
Bravo la France, et puis je suis très fier d'eux.
Congratulations to France. I'm very proud of them, especially our coach who led them to victory. Four goals, that can't be a coincidence. We deserved this victory against a team that everybody saw victorious.
Que tout le monde croyait qu'ils vont nous éliminer.
Sincèrement, je suis un peu déçu.
Honestly, I'm a little disappointed. I would have liked to see another country win this World Cup, but France played a wonderful game.
Un match digne de la finale. Mais sinon, bravo à la Croatie.
Those were Democratic Republic of Congo football fans who were cheering on the French team after their victory in Russia. Now, Jenny, it's interesting because there's been a lot of talk about, you know, how many players in the French team are of African descent, but nobody's mentioning players from Colombia or from, I don't know, from Peru or from even the Latin American countries.
But I think it's because of the number, because at the squad of around 20, 14 are of African descent.
Well, they are, but I mean, at the end of the day, they still are playing and they're wearing the French jersey. So I wouldn't be so enthusiastic and say, oh, well, this is the African team that won the World Cup. No, it's the French team that won the World Cup, not any African team.
Well, that is what you think, but people like to be identified with the winners. I mean, no one will like to be identified with the losers. And that is why everybody is like claiming they are Africans, they are French, they are what? So
That's right. Anyway, congratulations to the French team. And thank you for joining us on this edition of Africa Link. I'm Crispin Mwakideu.
And my name is Jean Nyinge.